SIR. I think we can start now. We can close the door for us. Let me first start by welcoming our guests here from CSIR, as led by the President and CEO, Peter Sbisi, and his executive. I'm sure they'll be able to introduce themselves to us and ourselves to them, because we are a new fourth parliament now. Even if they knew some of us before, they are very new faces this year. I think therefore it's important that we reintroduce ourselves as if we are all new. I've got a couple of announcements which I'll make a year after we introduce ourselves. I will start with myself here. I am Mabangobo, the chairperson of this committee, who is also a member of the African National Congress. I'll allow the member here that role to introduce themselves accordingly.
I am Namakwana Nyama, a member of the African National Congress and a member of this committee. Good morning. My name is Doris Mungwana from Gauteng, a member of this portfolio committee deployed by the ANC. Thanks.
Morning. I'm Langa Mkhize, the member of this portfolio committee.
Hi, I'm Marion Shin. I'm a Democratic Alliance member of this committee.
I'm Sana Molao from the Congress of the People, member of this committee.
I'm Dangi Musakene from Department of Water Affairs. I'm not a member of the committee, but then the DG requested us to attend this portfolio committee meeting. Thanks.
Good morning, Chair. I'm Marius Kitt from the Department of Water Affairs. I'm responsible for water quality management in the Upper Vaal water management area.
I want everybody to introduce him or herself. Yeah, I don't want to have people left out, because I don't want to see articles in newspapers that I do not know of, you know.
I'm Patricia McKenzie. I'm here from PMZ at the Monitor.
Vern Clentwood from PMG.
I'm Anne Muir from PMG.
I'm Renee Oswald-Mullen, researcher for this committee.
Arlene Paris from the CSR Parliamentary Office.
My name is George Kazuma from the Department of Science and Technology, Governance and Institutional Performance.
Landley Simpson from the Department of Science and Technology, sent by the Minister from the Socio-Economic Partnerships Division.
Aziza Frederick, CSR Parliamentary Office.
Good morning, Chair. Dozim Tertua, CSIR.
Good morning. I'm Reynold Zondo, the Executive Director.
I would like you to introduce yourself as what you do in the CSIR, because we want to know who are we with here.
Thank you, Chair. I'm the head of the Strategic Communications and Stakeholder Relations Unit within the CSIR.
Good morning. I'm Reynold Zondo. I'm the Executive Director for Services and a member of the Executive.
Good morning. My name is Pat Manders. I head up the unit CSIR Natural Resources and the Environment.
Good morning, all. My name is Chris Durdy. I'm the CFO at the CSIR.
Good morning. I am Thulani Dlamini. I'm the Group Executive for Research and Development at CSIR.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Hofi Maria. I'm the Group Executive for Operations at the CSIR.
Good
Good morning, honorable members. My name is Kunge Ganjobe. I'm the group executive for R&D Outcomes and Strategic Human Capital Development at the CSOR.
Good morning, honorable members. I'm Busiso Sbisi, Chief Executive Officer, CSOR.
Good morning. I'm Tebonza, my graphic designer at the CSOR.
Thank you very much for the introduction, and I think now we know one another, so it will be easy to start the business of the day. Before we continue, if you look at our program, we had planned to start with an item on the appointment of the Space Agency Board, but we think that it may inconvenience the business of the delegation. We have thought that it would be better to start with the business of the day directly, and then subsequently, after you have finished, then we can attend to our matters here as a committee. And so I hope that members will be with me in that. If there is any reservation, can I have a hand? Okay. So we will therefore, Dr. Smith, start directly with you, introduce your topic, and as a matter of procedure, yeah. After we've presented, members will interact with you on matters that they want clarification on, and so forth. And you can then jot down the questions from members. You can also allocate whoever probably is specific on the question from a delegation to address the members' concern or clarification. And so I'll treat it like that as before, as you know. Right, thank you.
Thank you, Chair. We'll present behind you, so you may have to shift a little. Thank you. Can also give us an indication of the length of time we have, so that we can judge how speedily we proceed and so on. We had understood the slot was 10 to 1, but to 12:30, okay. No, that's fine. Thank you, and thank you again, Chair and members of the committee, for this opportunity to share with you our annual report for 08-09, and we shall. It's presented by CSR executive. This is important to note. We work as a team, and while I will probably do the bulk of the talking, members of the executive will come in, and they will come in at appropriate points, and then they are free to interject at any point if they feel that I'm not representing the point I'm trying to make well enough, and so on. If we may then proceed on the basis of that understanding. Also, it's worth pointing out from the outset that while in principle we are addressing our performance in the particular year, 08-09, of necessity, in the nature of the game that we're in. Much of what we do is multi-year, and it becomes rather artificial to talk about it in chunks of time, as if one has got a set of targets that are met at the end of the year and we move on to something else. So there'll be a mix of talking about targets and how we performed relative to those targets for the given year, as well as talking about the continuity of the, as it were, the enterprise of scientific endeavor, and seeking to ensure that it has the appropriate impact on the lives of people of South Africa. So I'll start with a set of examples which illustrate what it is that we're about, give you a flavor of what it is that we do. And then at the end, tie it all by then linking it to the mandate, which is quite broad, of the organization, our value proposition, if you like, and the differentiator, who we are, what our identity is. But that will have been illustrated, hopefully, fairly clearly by the examples we shall make reference to. So on that note, let's then proceed to the first slide. I do not know whether it would be any clearer for these slides to be off. I do not know whether that's possible, but if people at the back are comfortable and they can see, that's okay. So part one will be a report back on 08-09, which has been a very good year for CSR, and I shall say what we mean by a very good year. In all those areas, human capital development, research performance indicators, and so on, finances, impact, investment in research infrastructure, very important element. I may have to do this one because, yeah, I may be. If it's possible to install. Yeah. So that's probably better. Is that clear? Can everyone hear me? Yeah. And then the overview as part two, where we, as it were, affirm the foundation. How are we aligned to the national priorities through the activities that we're engaged in? And what is indeed the CSR mandate? And what are the differentiators? What sets us apart? And what are areas of impact? Sets us apart is not quite the expression. But what role, what niche do we fulfill in the web of entities that seek to make a difference positively to the fortunes of the country? So the next slide, please. And so let's start by reporting on the 0809 year. I'm not sure that this is ideal. Okay, sorry, let's go back. Starting with what we're looking at up there are the set of areas where we should pay attention, and human capital development, output by way of publications, collaboration with other entities, be they private sector, public sector, universities, and so on, that are involved in research. Our research activities per se, the transfer of technology, and again, we would give examples of all of that. Financial performance and governance, which is obviously absolutely crucial. So let's go to the next slide. So there we are. There's ongoing commitment to learning, which is clearly demonstrated. We'll talk about that. TAC has succeeded with regard to publications. Rewarding sound collaborations, world-class standards in research, impact on science and economy, year-on-year improvement on financials, and maintenance of an unqualified audit report, which has been the case, I almost said since time immemorial, but for as long as I can remember, certainly for the duration that I've been there, CSR, and for considerably longer than that. So let's proceed. And now, just to give you a sense of CSR at a glance, the spread of the organization through the country, it is predominantly based in Pretoria, but we have a presence in all those places indicated there, Cape Town, Stellenbosch, PE, Devon, Pietermaritzburg, and Joburg, and so on, much smaller and focusing in particular areas, for example, mining activities in Joburg, activities that have to do with, say, coastal research and so on in Stellenbosch and so forth, textiles in PE, and anyway. 2,300 members of staff with 1,500 in what we call SET, Science, Engineering, and Technology base, which is what we're about. That's got to be strong. 457 with masters, 286 with PhDs, and we want to keep growing those numbers. It's essential. 53% of SET base is black, 33% is female, and baseline parliamentary grant financials. 480 million that we get from the public purse, and we're talking specifically about last year, and contract research, 955 million. What we mean by that is work that we do on behalf of third parties, that is other than the 480 million rand that we use for our discretionary research activities, that people are willing to, as it were, place contracts on us for us to perform work, and that's what we refer to as contract research. That's 955. And royalty income arising from work that we may have done some time ago and place a patent on it and commercialize that by us or by a party that we may have licensed to do so. And it may seem modest, but in this game it's actually rather difficult and slumpy. But that's, in fact, quite a good figure. And we'll talk about that in some detail later. And so, as an organization, we have a total operating income of some 1.5 billion. And so there we have it. Let's move on. Now, we'll start with human capital development, because ultimately what we do, oftentimes people will talk about technologies, they will talk about the science, but those are the outputs. That's what people do. The fundamental thing is that you also have the appropriate people and maintain the pipeline all the time of good people who are able to conduct the science, are able to set about developing the technologies that that are useful for purpose, and so the accent on continuously developing people is absolutely key. In fact, is arguably the most fundamental thing that we do at a level that is other than formal, complementary to formal tertiary education, because we're talking about people who've been through, as it were, the system, the schooling system, the formal system, who are now coming out and entering the workplace who may ultimately move on to populate the very industry that we seek to stimulate, either through startup companies or in a variety of other ways. So we are involved as far back as because we recognize the need to do so. If you look at the upper bar, as far back as some metric improvement programs, and then programs and scholarships and studentships within the organization, as well as permanent staff studying within the organization. Now, sitting right next to me, she introduced herself, Kunga Njobe. The portfolio of human capital development is one that she has nurtured and looked up and indeed done a sterling job in doing so, and I shall call upon her perhaps to comment a little further.
Thank you very much, Dr. Sivisi. The Human Capital Development Program in the CSR is we refocused it since 2005. In 2006, the CSR board adopted a strategy. The programs you see at the top are essentially what we call pipeline programs, which include students' support as well as interns. The Metric Improvement Program is a program we collaborated with Danel using their infrastructure, but we funded it and participated in identifying the participants in that program. And the idea is to be able to nurture those people into going for higher degrees, particularly in science and engineering. We had 40 participants in that. The bursaries and scholarships, these are students who are full-time at universities. The bursaries, we find them from CSR Perth on our own, and they're based studying for honors, masters, and PhDs. The scholarships, we actually collaborate with universities. In fact, this is one of the good programs through our collaboration with universities and other tertiary education institutions, where we put equal funding to support students in areas where we've decided to do research in as a collective. And then studentship programs are also full-time students, but this program differs in that these students are based on the CSR campus working on CSR projects, but are registered, of course, at universities and supported by both CSR mentors and university mentors. In total, we're sitting, of course, as you can see, with 350 student pipeline funded for BSc honors, masters, and PhDs, which is actually, I think, bodes well for our future in terms of capacity. And then the internship programs as well, of course, people who have qualified at minimum BSc honors come in to work for us for about a period of a year to get work experience. And then we actively support our own staff to qualify at masters and PhDs because we've had a legacy where we had quite a substantive number of our employees who didn't possess PhD qualifications and in some instances master's qualifications, which is actually quite essential if you perform research and development work. So we actively support them and, of course, they work on our projects and are registered at universities as well. And then we have development programs as well, like what we call the science, which are more leadership as well as imparting some skills that are necessary for doing research. So that's what that slide is showing. It's showing the kind of numbers of participants in those programs. And as Dr. Swiss has indicated, it's been a good success to date. If you could just move, do you want me to take the next one as well? Okay. I think it's one thing, members, to look at the numbers, but there are people behind these numbers, and we wanted to give you a bit of a glimpse into some of the participants in this program. Sibusisi Wakuluse is a research statistician in our built environment unit. And in fact, she's done very well. She's just completed her master's on modeling on extreme rainfall events. And she's actually just won now. In fact, she's very endowed at the moment because she's actually just won both the prestigious Mandela Rhodes Harvard South Africa Fellowship. And she's also won a scholarship fund funded or supported, sponsored by Tata, which is part of Women in Science initiative. As you can see, she's a very determined lady with very strong, base at home with a mother who's really, encouraged her to go for what she, the things that she's been able to achieve. If you could just move us to the next one. Mbumi Mkonza is a plant biotechnologist, also finished a master's PhD, also a master's program cum laude, and she's actually participating in a program. Her project actually is a project that is funded by Bill and Melinda Gates on fortification of biofortification of sorghum. It's an Africa-wide program, and she actually then was able to find a research topic as part of that, which is impressive. Of course, she's also very determined to move on to the next level in terms of her qualifications as well. So these are the kind of people who participate in our program. Do you want to, maybe the last example? This is one of our fewer students we support who's studying overseas. It's an expensive endeavor, and she's been an exceptional person, and she's done very well. She's currently completing a PhD at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland, and in fact, I've heard very good things about her enthusiasm and ideas. She's actually coming back to join us in the next year. So these are the kind of people who are behind this. There is a video, a short clip, which also gives you a feel of other individuals who speak for themselves in this time around. Okay.
Our has a policy of trying to grow human capital. CSIR also has huge collaborations with various universities and other research organizations. CSIR gives you the opportunity to study further. I am registered for a PhD in environmental management and particularly waste management with the University of Pretoria.
My mentor and I actually went to New Zealand, and we actually started the mechatronics degree over there. I think you need good mentorship, and you need to be in touch with yourself.
We have agreements with Google, with IBM, and our students spend time at their laboratory, sometimes for 3 month internship periods.
What I like most is that the freedom that you're given as a young scientist. You get to interact with a wide variety of people. Highly intellectual people as well, and I think that inspires me.
I joined the Satellite Application Center at the tender age of 21. Being able to say that we contribute towards the improvement, the betterment of society, of humanity, in a very little small way, however small it may be, it's fantastic knowing that you are.
The next slide. I assure you, honorable member, there are men. You'll see in the statistics. this is just again to show you the profile of our staff. One of the things we did in terms of the overall profile of the CSIR was to aim at increasing what you call our science, engineering, and technology base. In other words, the people who actually do research. And have that as the biggest proportion in the organization. So there's been a deliberate growth in that. As you can see, it's not huge jumps, but in absolute numbers, we've been definitely increasing the components of the people in our SET base. Similarly, as you saw on the other slides, the number of staff which we recruit into the CSIR possessing masters and PhDs or who come from our development programs has also been increasing. Last year we had the biggest jump up to, we had about additional 65 people who joined the organization with those levels of qualifications. So let's just go to the next slide, which is the one that really shows the honorable member that indeed we have men. in fact, we actually have a little bit of a challenge in the organization in terms of transformation demographics on the gender side. And that's why you can see that quite a lot of our development programs as well, we are really making sure that we see to it that there's a lot of women participating in these programs for masters and PhDs. Currently, we sit at about 33% of our science and engineering technology base who are women. It's not a good position, but as you can see in our investment programs, that's where we're also putting an emphasis. We're quite pleased that in the last year when we reported, we passed the 50% mark in terms of race demographics. We're now sitting at 53% of our staff in sort of our science and engineering technology base being black. So we're also quite actively driving the transformation agenda in the CSR. So that's the human capital development story in a nutshell. There's obviously a lot more when members have an opportunity to visit.
Thank you, Kunga. I'll spend quite some time on that because we really think, I want to emphasize again, that it is the bedrock of everything else that we do. Indeed, Kunga, I believe at the level of supporting PhD people, probably, I speak correctly, that we are the second yes. after Sasol in the country. So let's move on a bit more quickly with regard to the other indicators compared to last year. Publications increase of 32%, collaborative research projects with tertiary education institutions, we're consolidating in that area, and our contract research income supporting national strategies, i.e. that component of that 955 that's aligned with national strategies. I'll talk more about that later. Some 450 million, an increase of more than 76 million. And that's talk a little bit more on financials, a slide or two on financials and corporate governance before we then move on to some examples of what it is that our people do. Chris, the CFO, will speak to that.
Thank you, Dr. Bisi. The finances are essentially a very good news story for the CSR. Our total operating income, you'll see on the slide, is up by 21%. We're just shy of 1.5 billion. Parliamentary grant increased by 12% to 480 million. The contract income, you saw these numbers slightly earlier, but the increase is 23% to 955 million. And the royalty income for the CSR group, up by 119% to 36 million. The net profit of the organization is 58 million, an increase of 7%. And if you look at our balance sheet remains strong. We are able to support future investments in scientific infrastructure through the reserves on our balance sheet. Probably the most important thing on this slide is the governance issue. And recently, I think about 2 weeks ago, the Auditor General's office was on a national radio station talking about the results of the recent audits. And when the radio host asked him to name organizations that subscribe to good governance, the immediate response from the Auditor General's office is, the first one that comes to mind is CSR. We work very hard at corporate governance. It's a track record that we guard jealously. And it's something that's very important to us. And if we move to the next slide, please. This is just a slide, one, to prove that accountants do have a sense of humor. Also, just to just to make a point, we've got the Wall Street Bank on the left. I hope you don't deem us presumptuous to put Einstein on the stool representing CSR. But just to say, we take a holistic view of governance. It's not just the financial governance. What's important is science. We have ethics committees in place. We have research advisory panels. We have the good guide to research. We make sure our labs are safe and people are properly trained. Kangeka spoke earlier about the investments we make in people. We want to create a place where people have a sense of ownership with the CSR. We take them through courses on the PFMA and point out pitfalls, even though they are scientists. And ultimately what we want is a sense of pride in the CSR brand and a sense of pride in terms of what we're doing in terms of our mandate, and that is making a difference in people's lives. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Chris. Indeed, as Chris says, we send everyone, including the CEO, on courses on good corporate governance. I first saw that slide at the presentation that had gone to by Judge Mervyn King on King 3, and he had a variant of that slide which we found useful and resonated with exactly who we are. We've just changed the labels on the legs a little, where it said environment, it said science. And where we say people, we're not just talking about our own people that we've looked at within the organization. But ultimately, that symbolizes exactly what we're about, the impact that we have on the country, on the economy, on and society, and therefore ultimately making a difference to the well-being of people. So let's move on then, if we may, to some impact stories arising from the activities that we were involved in. We'll talk about two elements. We'll talk about some examples of the research activities that we conduct, always motivated by what is the challenge, what is the problem that we are seeking to address that is going to make a difference in the world, rather than being motivated by no doubt an equally worthy reason to be conducting research, but which may not necessarily be in keeping with our mandate as CSIR. You might be interested in astronomy, for example, and how the universe came to be the way it is. That's a question that sits very nicely in a university academic setting. In our context, there must be a very clear link to the manner in which you expect your work to make a difference to the lives of people. So yeah, that will emerge hopefully from the stories we're going to tell. And let's start with the research impact examples. And here's one activity that has to do with our transmission lines, not directly in energy generation per se, but the integrity of transmission lines that we did with Eskom. In fact, I'm tempted at this point to bring in at this stage and for the next topic, Hoffi, the operations executive of CSIR, to speak to both these projects. Hoffi, all yours.
Thank you, Dr. Sabisi. With Eskom lines and high power lines, you get faults beginning to happen before the line breaks, and it creates a corona around the line. And you can see that if you go off the visible spectrum, if you go UV, for instance. Ultraviolet. Okay. Thank you, Dr. BC. And so we developed a camera that can see this corona, and we started doing that for Eskom. This developed into something that came to the next model and the next model, and finally we have one that can actually work in daylight, and it has now been accepted worldwide, and it's been copied by others, but we have appointed people to sell this, and we've sold it in a number of countries worldwide. So it is it's bringing science to the maintenance of the electricity grid, and it's playing not the main part, but a good supporting part. And maybe I can stop there, but just to say we are in the process of now setting up a little company that will manufacture these cameras and sell them worldwide. I think that's maybe good enough for that.
Adding here, although it's not direct on the slide, that you can, on the one hand, have an individual holding such a camera and going down looking at the transmission line, but there are miles and miles and miles, kilometers of transmission line. So what to do if you want to monitor the transmission line over a long distance? So you might then consider, for example, having an unmanned aerial vehicle, a light one, and mount the camera underneath, and because you know the GPS coordinates, global positioning system coordinates of the lines, then you can fly over and take data continuously. Now, that is an example of what we shall refer to earlier as later in the conversation. As the strength of CSIR, the multidisciplinarity, the ability to talk about people who have expertise in sensors to make cameras like that, with people who have expertise in how to make unmanned aerial vehicles, all within the same organization. That is a strength not to be underestimated, because they're then able to bring to bear the variety of disciplines necessary properly to engage with real life problems.
I think members did not try to really.
Yeah, the training is the challenge. Yeah. Yes. Okay. There's an interesting story actually here. This is work. Now this illustrates several points, including the very important point that work you do now might have an impact a lot later, and that's the nature of scientific endeavor. In this particular instance, there was work on lithium-ion battery technology back in the 1980s by a CSIR team led by Dr. Michael Thackeray, who subsequently moved to the United States. And they discovered that a particular technology, manganese spinel as a cathode, it does not matter what the details are, and we had a patent in 1982. and licensed to major Japanese multinationals in 85, and a patent prosecution led to Japanese and US patents being granted in 08 and 09. And but one is cutting the story short, and then the people, Chris here, can probably tell the story very nicely. We were there. There was a time when we needed to go and negotiate and get the people violating our patent in Japan to agree that they are, and therefore to then ultimately pay a royalty, which they eventually did do acknowledge and pay. But it just indicates how tough that activity is in practice. In, we will often tell the clinical story of we develop technology, place a patent, and commercialize. But in fact, the world is much more complicated than that, and people are not going to simply violate the patent and see whether or not you've got the wherewithal to prosecute internationally and so on. And then and these are issues we need to really bear in mind as a country when we try to enter the game of the high-stakes game of the deployment of technology internationally. In any case, we are now collaborating with ITC to establish a local lithium-ion battery industry. This is coupled to the development of the South African electric car, the Joule, and we had more than 15 million royalty revenue during 08-09 from this activity. And it's also useful in the storing of solar energy, which we may have an opportunity to talk about. Tulani may want to come in either now or at that stage later on that one. Do you want to?
Thank you very much, Dr. Felicity. We have a huge program within the CSIR looking at renewable energy sources to complement, of course, the energy production in the country. And a significant component of what we're looking at is looking at utilizing the sun, which, of course, we all know is one of the abundant resources that we have within this country as an energy source. Of course, we're looking at developing different types of materials that we can use in terms of the construction of solar panels and also setting up a heliostat fields, which we can utilize in terms of energy generation. But part of this is to look at also technology that we can use to store energy, and hence the initiative to develop competencies and technologies around the battery and fit in very well with our ability to generate electricity, but also to be able to store it for future use. I think that's what I can say right now.
Thank you, Tula. And just to emphasize the point again, when this technology was developed, it was before the proliferation of devices like it, mobile devices that need to have batteries in them, batteries of technologies of that nature or similar. So the market may not have been there at the time, but it's grown over a period of time. And the challenge always is in the scientific arena, striking the balance between maintaining a scientific competence that may not realize commercial value in the foreseeable future, and then actually abandoning it because of constraints on resources and so on, and moving on to something else, perhaps something that's more short-term where you can see what the likely benefits are. There are pros and cons to that. Clearly, there's a risk to simply maintaining something that may never be of use. But on the other hand, you then lose out on things that may be the basis for competitive advantage in 20 years' time. There's another example that one could go into of that in the context of, cellular networks. Going back to the 50s, where a CSIR scientist by the name of Trevor Watley developed what is now used as a basis for networks for cellular communications. But it's companies elsewhere that have ultimately benefited from that by way of taking the technology further. But that's a story in its own right that we could talk about in a bit more detail. Chris, did you want to add anything
Maybe just to say, last year was an important step. Sanyo was the first company who signed up to pay royalties. All the big names are infringing: Sony, Panasonic, Sanyo, Hitachi. And what's good about this is it now opens up the door for us when we go speak to LG, Panasonic. We can say Sanyo signed up, and potentially now they will be more lenient and willing to meet with us. What also helps is Sanyo is now telling us who's infringing, because obviously they don't want the other companies to have a competitive advantage. So things are starting to move quite quickly in this space now, and we're very excited about the prospects of the lithium battery.
move on to another example, and the better technology example, and I will once again ask Kofi to come in on this one, because I was very closely involved with it.
Thank you, Spook. If you look at the plastic bottle, it's kind of nice to contain fluid, but it's actually permeable to oxygen and carbon dioxide. And that's why some of your foodstuffs are not contained in plastic bottles. And especially some of the baby foods and stuff like that are kept in glass. Now think of the weight of glass. Think of the carbon footprint of transporting all this glass around. And if you want to go a little bit more social, think of beer, either in cans or in bottles. And some people say that's the way people want it, but think of the weight of being transported around like that. So how to make plastic less permeable to oxygen or carbon dioxide? We developed a coating on the outside, and we were very proud. We did the test, and we could show our coating is much better than anything else, so we thought the market would now rush to us and buy this from us. The real truth was no, because we could do it in the laboratory, but in real practice, they make these bottles at 20, 30,000 per hour. So you have to get it upscaled from your lab model to something that goes through the production line. So we went off to our industry, and I don't know if I should name them, but we thought they would jump, and they were all very impressed, up to the level of MDs, but they all said, can you get some international company to prove this technology for us first? So we were a bit deflated, but we then found a Canadian company that was very keen. And this Canadian company has been working with us now for the last 4 years, and we seem to have it right now. We then had to get, if you want to go into the big markets like America and Europe, you have to get FDA, Food and Drug Administration, approval. Is this thing okay for foods? Will it poison you or anything like that? We managed to get that. We've got the patent. We managed to get that done. And we're now ready to go much wider. And we're dealing with companies like PepsiCo internationally, Kraft Foods internationally. They were actually going to set up a line in Germany end of last year. And then the financial crisis happened and capital projects were frozen. But we're very, very proud of what we've achieved so far. We've kept South Africa out. We want to give local companies an opportunity. And I'm glad to say, I just forgot the name of the company, but there's a company here in Cyrus, in South River that's looking at using this as well. Okay, so we hope to see more of this in the future, and we're kind of very happy with the way it has happened. But we also learned that when we thought it was ready for the market, we had to spend another 5 to 6 years before it actually broke through. Thank you.
Super, thanks, Sophie. Incidentally, when we get to another example we'll talk about here, we'll make the point again about multidisciplinary. The technology on polymers that is used here is also used in a totally different context when we talk about nanoparticles for drug delivery in the human body. But we'll get to that in a moment. So let's move on and then talk about our water-related research. This is a list of examples of activity in our water-related research. It's a combination of activities where we're doing research in the classical sense of trying to find a technology solution to a problem, such as the acid mine drainage problem, through to conducting studies, because you need to base statements you make on evidence, to be able to make evidence-based statements regarding, for example, the status of the Olifants River, we'll talk about that, or the water bank to determine the ecological status prior to operations of new coal power plants, and so on. And there's a whole variety of other projects here. And what I'd like to do is to, colleagues may want to comment on some particular ones here before we move on and talk about specifically the first two, and I'll invite Pat Mendes to speak to that.
Thank you, Dr. Sabisi. If I can maybe just put out a few of those examples, and as you say, I think we'll talk a bit more detail around the first two just now. The Waterberg is important because of the planned mining operations and energy power generation activities planned for that area. It also provides us a baseline of a fairly intact ecosystem that we can use to compare what's happening in places like the North Coast. Green Building Handbook, of course, that all relates to how does one in the economy use more water and other resources more efficiently and effectively? Mercury is quite an important study that we've now completed, funded by Parliamentary Grant and Water Research Commission and others. South Africa was reported to be a very high mercury environment based on estimations from our coal burning. Actual measurements have suggested that the problems may not be as great as previously considered, but there are some areas that do deserve some further investigation, and we will hope to continue with that. Cholera is an important thing. What we're trying to look there is specifically when there's a cholera outbreak, there's a medical response to that, clinical response. But can we understand the environmental drivers of cholera outbreaks, under what conditions does it happen, so we can anticipate cholera outbreaks and try and prevent rather than cure? We have got some indication on that, and again, that's an area that we would like to continue doing further work. Endocrine disrupting chemicals are quite problematic, and we've also recently published with Water Research Commission funding on that. And maybe I think those are the key ones that I would refer to. The others are looking to the future in terms of treatment, and also the ecologies. This is important to understand how we manage and maintain the systems that deliver the water that we need to use. Thank you, Doctor. Maybe I could have the next slide.
Probably this is also worth mentioning, that pitch on the right gives a good indication
Thank you for raising that. I think the point there is that if you were to draw the on that map a line where the world average rainfall would sit, it would sort of be in that light greenish color. Okay. In other words, most of South Africa, apart from the eastern part of the country, is below average rainfall. That just gives you a very stark picture of the nature of the problem we face in the country compared to our neighbours to the north. We are far better endowed with rainfall and water resources. We have to be very, very careful with what we have. Can we move on there? Thank you. And I think this is an introductory slide. Let's move on to the actual example. We have a strong mining history. Mining is a very important part of our economy. But when you dig holes in the ground and expose the ore to water that infiltrates and you allow oxygen into there, you create an acidic environment. And under that acidic environment, the chemistry of the well, there's a chemical reaction between the water and the ores, and one ends up with water that is not very good. It is high sulfate content. It's got metals in it, other things, and it's acidic typically. Very often, and when you've got reasonable rainfall, as we do, for example, on the West Rand and in Mpumalanga, those mines tend to fill up in time if they're not being actively pumped, and they get to a point where there's decant, when that water starts to move out of the mines into the surface environment. And even before then, it can be influencing groundwater that people may be using. So the question is, how does one deal with that? The volumes are big. The estimate for in Gauteng, if the mines in Gauteng get to the point to decant, we're looking at something around 360 megalitres a day. My rough estimation that this entire room is one half of one megalitre, so it gives you an indication of the volumes of water per day that would be decanted into their surface environment, which would be problematic. So how do we deal with that? How do we try and avoid that situation is a key question. Thank you. Next slide, please, John. Thank you. We have various technologies that we've been applying for a while. They're not the only technologies in the world. There are other technologies. But what is important about ours is that we have been trying to move towards a zero-waste treatment process. Many other treatment processes result in another waste stream. It could be gypsum, for example, that has to be disposed of somewhere along the line, or some horrible brine. So what we're trying to do is find one that is zero waste, so you don't get those points or other problems developing. It also provides the opportunity to recover important products. South Africa imports salsa into the country at the moment for industrial processes, and here we're sitting with high sulfur containing water, so there's a solution, there's an opportunity in that problem, if I can put it that way. So our technologies are designed to neutralize the water, remove metals, which some of them are also quite valuable, recover sulfur, for example, and get water to the point that it can be reused or in industry, or even maybe take it to potable levels if the treatment is sufficient. I think the other important point around the zero waste concept,
we have a limited supply of neutralizing chemicals, calcium carbonate, in the country. We can't there's no infinite supply, and the new power generation will be using a lot of that for scrubbing. I'm not too sure where it's going to come from. Our treatment technologies will allow that to be recycled and reused over and over again. So that's quite an important point as well. If I could have the next slide, please. So we're currently working with Western Utilities Corporation. You may well have seen some mention of that in the press. There is a debate going on about who should pay and so on and so forth, and that is probably a good debate to have. But it doesn't change the fact that we need to find a way of treating their water before it decants and to avoid that decanting into an environment. There's a bit of a race against time. Can we get the treatment in place before that does happen? And that depends on rainfall over the next while to a large extent. So that's a good example, and there were earlier discussions around how one commercializes technology to make a difference. And here we are dependent on working with implementation partners, people who build plants, who run treatment plants, to take our technologies into the real world. And we are working very hard with them to make it work fit for purpose. Thank you. And then the other area that is was mentioned is Lake Loskop. I think the point of the matter, again, in the press, one has seen reports on crocodile death. What causes it is the immediate question. We don't have the answer to that yet, but we have a very serious situation there. And what we need to do is develop a comprehensive understanding of what is happening in that system. We're busy working on that right now. This is a serious problem. And we're working with many stakeholders and research institutions that process, including colleagues in the Department of Water Affairs, who are actually helping us in the field, and we interact with them in terms of what's emerging in that research. But please understand, the implications for people living in the area, the implications for agriculture could be quite serious. That's a very important agricultural exporting environment. A billion plus, aside from the rands, is something about 35,000 jobs in that rural economy. If nobody wants to buy that food, the economy of that economy could be seriously affected. So, as I say, we are looking to develop a comprehensive understanding. It's not a simple thing. You can't just point a finger at the mines and say, you caused the problem. It goes way beyond that. And it's a very complex situation. We need to understand the complexity in order to understand how we can mitigate and deal with the situation. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Scott.
Maybe just on the last issue, just say that we have some early results. We're now in a verification process to make certain our results are right.
Yeah.
And we hope to have something towards January or somewhere there. Is that right?
We hope by, during the course of November, people are actually going up to the field, a very big field visit next week, to verify some of our information. And I think on a continuous basis, as we understand more, we need to be feeding that back to our colleagues in the department to help them figure out how do we go forward and deal with the situation.
Thanks. Before we move on, I think what we've seen here is, in this instance, as you indicate, a case where we have to be very clear what it is that's going on and get the data and be able to draw the appropriate inferences from that. And the instance before, it's a nice illustration of developing a technology to solve a problem, and then the point at which we as an organization handshake with other parties. And that's something that is important to understand, because often we're asked, how far down do we go? We are not necessarily going to then deploy and run a service on acid mine drainage as an organization, but then we then would handshake with an existing industry or spawn a new company that will then be involved in the actual deployment in the field of these technologies we've developed. So then let's move on to, in this sector, a last class of examples. In the infrastructure area, the built environment, where in this example we are looking at ultra thin concrete roads that developed as CSI. Yet again, I might well call upon one of my executive colleagues, Hoffi, to undertake that one, Tulan, or whoever.
Chair, this is a problem in the sense that we want to surface all the roads in the townships, in the rural areas, And very quickly you have huge square meters and many kilometers to do and limited funds. So the continuous question is, can you do it cheaper? But the next question is, but without having failures. Otherwise, it's just a cheap job. Okay. So we would like to find a way. And what we came up with is this ultra-thin concrete road. Initially, there was a lot of skepticism, and there's still maybe some residual questions remaining. But we have now tried it in a number of places. We have now gone full scale in some areas like in Mamelodi. We've also dealt with the roads agency, National Roads Agency, where they said, you can put some sections down near toll gates where we can monitor under real big traffic what will happen. And so far it is done quite well. And we think it's a solution. And it's also very labor intensive. And it will hopefully live up to the quality standards. And we're proving that at the moment. And then maybe just to say that we've got examples in Mamelodi, Shoshanguve around ourselves, but we've now started trying to use this in some other areas. There is a resistance to change, as you can expect. So instead of accolades, we sometimes got some negative feedback in saying, why do we want to change over to this? But we think this, we have to be more clever in the way we produce and provide basic services like roads and even houses. Because we now think perhaps you can use this thin concrete as a base slab for low-cost housing. And we actually have an example at the CSR on our site where we just tried that. We're taking that to the DG of Science and Technology and the press in a couple of weeks' time.
We built a whole house, and so it's a good demonstration. In conceptual, it's very nice because you can lay down roads and lay down strips that you then put houses on. It may well be, and here one should be a little cautious, but it may well be the case that you might then be able to deal better as well that way with dolomitic areas. After all, that's what tends to happen as a building specification when you build an area like that, put a slab and then build on it. That's a story in its own right, and let's take another one, a last one in this area, which is yet again an example of not so much research but of gathering data in order to be able to assist decision-making, policy formulation. In this instance, it's what we call the State of Logistics Survey. We started doing it a few years ago, some 3 or 4 years ago, to join the small number of countries, mostly in the highly developed economies, in getting a sense, collecting data on what it costs to move goods around the country to and fro on roads and so on, to store goods, say at harbors before they get collected by ships and so on, move them back sometimes. It makes for interesting reading, because in our instance, for example, we've been doing it since 2004, and we did it in partnership with Stellenbosch and Imperial Logistics. And the internal logistics cost of 15.7% of GDP, so it's just far too high. Even India is at 12%, Brazil at 12%, Australia at 11%, and then countries like the US below 10%. And so the issue is, what is it that we can do in order to bring that down? By way, for example, of having a better railway system. Then we start taking a view on what the appropriate interventions are. Sometimes it's things to do with goods just waiting at the harbor for a longer time than is necessary. How can you ensure that you have appropriate communication mechanisms so that at the time that the boat arrives to collect, the ship arrives to collect coal, it's at the point, in just-in-time mode, it's at the point that it's being delivered, and etc. It is worth noting that if we were able to reduce that by 2% of GDP, that would pay fully for all the R&D expenditure of the country, which is currently sitting at a number of around 1% or so. Anyway, I was slightly under. Anyway, let's go back then and talk a little bit on some activities that are in research and development mode with the potential, the promise of deployment in and the appropriate impact in making a difference. And perhaps I might let's move on to the next slide. With our activities fighting TB using nanoparticles, very small particles that are absorbed through the stomach lining into the bloodstream and then released slowly, contained in polymer materials. The expertise, the same expertise as I indicated earlier, of polymer science that we refer to in the case of the barrier technologies for plastic bottles. Tulani, do you want to perhaps take this one and perhaps the following ones? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Sbisi. One of the problems with TB, which I think contributes significantly towards us struggling to deal with this disease, is the non-compliance of patients who have TB and are taking treatment for TB. And one of the reasons that we have observed contribute towards the non-compliance is, first of all, the fact that patients need to take a large number of drugs on a daily basis for very long periods of time. And as a result of that, a number of patients then don't comply. There are other factors, of course, which contribute towards this. Within the CSIR, we'll be looking at how can we address this issue of non-compliance using our understanding of nanotechnology and polymer science by developing drugs and encapsulating them in a material which will allow them to be slowly released into the body in such a way that you only need to take a drug once, for instance, in a week. And in that way, of course, it contributes, I think, significantly towards improving the quality of life of the people that are infected with TB. And of course, it will address the issue of non-compliance. We've had very good success, in fact, with regards to this study, where we've shown with the rats at this stage and at this point in time a significant improvement, firstly, in the level of uptake of the drugs that are used that cure TB, but also the level of availability of these drugs within the bloodstream of a rat for much longer periods than if you were to take these drugs using the conventional way. I must also mention at this point that because of the problems I've highlighted earlier on with TB, often the number of patients who have TB end up having what is called multi-drug resistant TB. So we hope that by developing this technology, we'll first of all address the issue of TB, but also deal with the issue of multi-drug resistant TB. If you can move to the next slide, please. Just continue. Maybe on the, if you could go back to the previous slide, I just want to highlight a point that the team that is working on this project within the CSIR, they're working in a consortium format with a number of researchers from South Africa as well as abroad. And in this year, in fact, they were successful in a business plan competition where they received about 15 million rand to support the advancement of this technology. It's a very competitive a program that they participated in, which shows that I think the work that is being done here is of a world class nature. I think within this area also of health, which is a focus within the CSIR, we're also looking at developing drugs that can be utilized to also deal with the issue of malaria. If you can go to the next slide. Currently, there is close to 880,000 people that are affected by malaria on an annual basis, and 91% of these are within Africa. One of the problems with malaria, which is similar to what we experience with TB, is that the parasite that is responsible for malaria changes over time, and therefore drugs which have been developed to treat malaria, you find that often they are not as effective as what they are supposed to be. As a result, then you have a number of fatalities from malaria, where of course one would expect that because there are drugs available, there should not be any fatalities coming out as a result of people being infected with malaria. Within the CSIR, we're looking at developing various drug leads, which we would like to evaluate for the treatment of malaria. Of course, what we're looking for here are drugs that show much higher activity for dealing with the malaria parasite than what is currently available. And we've been successful in this regard. One of the drugs that we've developed shows more than 1,000 times more activity than the drugs which are currently utilized for the treatment of malaria. I think this is also very, very promising work that we are developing within this area. We're also looking at using natural products, working with local indigenous and healers to use some of the indigenously available compounds that we can also evaluate for the treatment of malaria. Thank you.
Move on perhaps to a last example and in this class of examples. Let's move on. Yeah. Radar for improved security. Radar is an area of very strong area of competence within CSIR over many years in the context of our defense activities. Radar, of course, is a mode of surveillance which has applications not just in a defense context but in a civilian context as well. And what we are doing here is to make use of our expertise, which incidentally is a truly formidable expertise. It's well worth pointing out that when the group goes to conferences with peers, it is often the case that the peers, and I'm talking about people in countries such as the U.S., will end up gathering around the demonstration that is given by the people from our institution, because it is in the respects in which they're looking at the head of the game. And so we're really talking about truly formidable expertise. Anyway, what we have here, let's move on, is a description of what the challenge is, protecting SAA, its borders and surrounding maritime zones to just have a sense of what's going on, what the threats are by way of illegal fishing, smuggling, illegal immigration, oil pollution, etc. And then much of it, you know, it's criminal activity. Criminals have initiative who are doing illegal fishing, for example, to choose place and time and method, fly low, use smaller craft, operate among similar non-threatening entities, in other words, camouflage, hide amongst boats that maybe genuine fishing boats, doing it legally, and be the reaction time of security forces and so on. Security issues at major events such as the 2010 World Cup, absolutely critical. And one could talk a little bit more about our involvement in the Confederation Cup event, because what we have to do there is to put together various modalities of surveillance, ranging from looking at just ordinary images, say, taken from above of movements of people, and at night we might be looking at what we refer to as infrared images, which pick up your heat signature, and then looking at how people move around and trying to pick up suspicious behavior, and then combine that.
I can see people are beginning to browse it because of the temperature. I was just trying to say that you must open up some aircon system so that we can refresh, as people are getting more and more sleepy. Have you opened? Yeah, okay.
Thank you, Chair, for the reassurance that is not the nature and content of our presentation. what then do we do? And if we have looked there, over here, that shaded gray area is an indication, and over here, of the territorial waters, that are South African territorial waters. And what happened is that the law of the sea changed so that the territorial waters, what's called the EEZ, Exclusive Economic Zone, grew substantially. There were certain conditions associated with it, but the implication is that you then have far more area of territorial waters to monitor by way of people engaged in illegal activities as far out as Marin Islands and so on. So that is the challenge. And you can't simply use high masts and put cameras on the coast, because ultimately you get bitten by the curvature of the earth. You can't see far enough. So what to do? And let's move on to the next slide. And so what we want to do at developing a system that we refer to as our NAP, a concept unique to Southern African needs, which is underpinned by radar sensors, electro-optical sensors, or these are areas of technology strength within our organization. Unmanned aerial vehicles, and you can see data fusion, stratosphere, it's combining a whole host of areas of competence, where you might then have these unmanned aerial vehicles hovering over that a huge area like this, with maybe several of them sort of coverage as indicated there, that are continuously collecting data, and we'd use different types of sensors. Some may be in the optical domain, but you can't use optical sensors, for example, when it's cloudy and you want to see through cloud, then you need to use radar and so on. And then linked to that, of course, is the technology, the communication expertise that would must allow you to then make the data available in real time to people who may then react, take decisions on what to do about the behavior of a particular trawler, for example. And it's important here to recognize that it's not just spotting an individual rogue ship once every 12 hours or every 6 hours, that is the issue. You may have to monitor much more closely, because it's the pattern of behavior that gives an indication of the intent of the party in question, rather than necessarily that they were here at this point in time and here at this other point much later in time. What we're illustrating here is that here the competence built over time, the original intent may be been in the defense sector, and indeed the applications continue in that area, but that there's a host of applications outside of the defense arena that we're pursuing in civilian surveillance. Okay, that's the sum total of what we want to say by way of examples. Let's hit the back button. All of this is underpinned by world-class research infrastructure. It has to be. You need equipment, you need, and perhaps let's hit the button. Let's just give a sense. We spoke earlier about an increase in our margin and so on, but what do we do? We actually invest back in building the scientific infrastructure. There are two elements to being strong in these activities. It is the people, as we spoke about, it is the infrastructure. And that's what we're talking about. Cutting-edge equipment, we can give examples of it here. And so that gives a sense of our expenditure over time increasing. And we took a conscious decision about here that we are running a risk now where we are no longer able to compete and do some of the cutting-edge work we need to do because of an infrastructure challenge. And we started investing. And I must say that this is not just investment. What we're seeing here is investment, this is our own investment, Chris, that's correct, but we were also supported very strongly by the Department of Science and Technology in this regard, and we're very grateful for that. I don't know whether you may want to say a bit more about that, and much of it lives in the general infrastructure arena that also Reynold, you look after, you, so feel free to come in at any stage in this regard. One can go and I'll show a picture, maybe coastal. Just infrastructure like that. This is a model hall to model the behavior of when designing a new harbor. How is it likely to behave? What are the water levels likely to be? How is it likely to affect the ambient area and so on? I need to simulate all of this in a real miniature environment, but that will simulate very realistically what will happen in real life before you scale up. And we have a facility to do that here in Stellenbosch. Some of it, there's a debate on how much you can do, by modeling entirely on computers. But that's a story in its own right. And I won't go through all of this cyber, perhaps. That's just, we need supercomputers. And here in Cape Town, we have a powerful center for high-performance computing. Which we think might well, at the next benchmarking exercise, make the list of the 500 top such centers in the world after some recent upgrades at this center. And that is linked to the South African National Research Network, which is under construction, which is absolutely essential. The bandwidth is otherwise we're not playing the game. If we are serious about being involved in this game, we must have sufficient bandwidth amongst research institutions and so on, and other associated institutions, and of course links internationally. And you know, one can, there's a story behind it, it's one of these and I won't necessarily try and explain here, but things like what are called transmission electron microscopes, these are very important, a very expensive piece of equipment, but you are nowhere in this game unless you have equipment like that. You just have to have it, period. There's no two ways about it. And in this particular case, the center is not just a CSR center, but it's used by people nationally. People come from everywhere, various universities, and come and conduct and use the facilities and go back to their institutions. Hit satellites maybe, and then I'll stop. You saw in the video earlier someone from the Satellite Application Center, and you need facilities. It's too nice a picture not to show with the backdrop over there. So for dishes like that which you see pointing up at the sky, which are essential for tracking satellites when they're launched, are also important for downloading data from satellites, remotely sensed data of the Earth. Which you then use for disaster mitigation, for land decision making, and so on. Quite apart from the story one would want to tell here has to do with that, there's a whole other story of similar equipment for radio astronomy purposes, but that's a story in its own right. Okay, I think let's move on to part two, which we'll try and be brief on. So we've given examples, really given us a sense of the very thing that we do. You might say, okay, how do you choose, how do you decide what to do? It's all very broad. Let's move on.
Well, committed. I think you have about 7 minutes.
I'll take three. You committed to national priorities, improved healthcare. You'll see that a lot of our examples speak to one or the other area, rural development, food security, and so on, fight against crime and the like. And we also support the DST 10-year plan, which Department of Science October, I believe, presented to this committee at some stage. Let's move on. Then the mandate, it is really a bit of a mouthful, but the key words are conducting directed multidisciplinary research and technology innovation to foster industrial and scientific development to improve the quality of life for the people of the country. Now, that's very broad. It does not specify, therefore, this is what you will do. These are the areas of activity. These are the technology, the sectors you will work in. So, ongoing consultations with stakeholders and so on to continuously refine what it is that we're doing, and we're working in those areas that indeed are relevant for us to be working on to address the problems of today, but also not only that, and perhaps more importantly, to anticipate the challenges of tomorrow, and that can be extremely tricky. And so let's move on quickly. So we stand the full research, development, and innovation chain, either by ourselves or in cooperation, in collaboration with partners, as the mandate says. And really the key here is the multidisciplinary, integrative nature of what we do. The complex problems necessarily require crossing the boundaries between maths, biology, chemistry, physics, computer science, and so on. And CSR houses these multidisciplinary competences. It's much easier to then get to work together than to try and do so across different institutions. That must be encouraged as well, partnerships across institutions. But and indeed, we do. But I think we have something unique here in having various competences within a single organization. Next slide. Currently our areas of impact at a very high level, if we must put them down, I shan't talk in detail, health, natural environment, energy, alternative and renewables, built environment, and stimulating industry, defense and security, underpinned by a whole host of technologies, the research infrastructure we spoke about, materials, the polymer sciences and so on, information and communication technologies, and various others. All the examples that we discussed fall into one or the other one of these high-level areas of application. Of course, there are other. One can have a take on health that has to do not with technology per se, but that has to do, for example, with behavioral awareness, with nutrition, and so on. Our angle to this is science and technology. Okay, let's move on. And again, to emphasize the point of drawing on a variety of competences to address a particular area like energy, that will call upon our competences within the organization in material science and polymers and so on, infrastructure engineering and then so on, marine sciences, plant biotechnology. So it is a complex problem, high-level problem that we're engaged in. We'll find maps in that way to a variety of competences. Next slide. And yeah, so in closing, just a selection of quotes by a variety of people. On, for example, we didn't talk in detail about that example, problem-derived virus, neutralizing antibodies in tuberculosis. There was recently a story on that, I think, in the media. If approved, this will be the first time in the world and may represent a Trojan horse for the whole field of plant-based products. This is a reviewer of the work. And mathematical modeling to describe natural phenomena for Airbus, this is Airbus, found the demonstrated approach both scientifically innovative and potentially of great practical application, and so on. This is just to give a sense of what do other people have to say, rather than just what we tell you, which you might be entitled to feel that there might be an element of hyperbole. So let's move on. So on that note, thank you very much, and I hope I'm within 7 minutes. Oh, I'll go back one slide, and perhaps just stay there. Okay. So, Chair, why in your hands?
Are these just extracts, or is it part of what you are doing in your research?
Comment on what we are doing, and these are examples of what people have said, and I could tell you a full story. Perhaps when you come visiting at some stage, etc.
What about the Airbus?
It's mathematical modeling that we're doing in structural design for Airbus. Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much. I think I will stay. I'll keep on here because I want people to be able to see slides. Should they want to browse on any of those. Thank you very much for all the presenters, your efficient presentations. I think for me it is the committee to talk whether they have liked what you have said or not, and whether they recommend that this report is at the level where the committee feels that right, if done good work. But I just have a matter of comment. It would have been better, but I know that it should probably come. The committee is still finding its feet. But you see, when you bring it an annual report, the annual report is actually reporting what you came to say at the beginning of the year about what you are going to be doing in your strat plan. You don't have to just say anything that you do, but you must try and be systematic. That on this question or on this problem, this is what we said we wanted to do. And these are the things that we have done, and this is where we have had challenges because of this and those reasons. And this is how we hope in the coming months to sort out those challenges and so forth and so forth. This is how actually the training that we have received in Parliament suggests that this is how government departments and entities are supposed to present their reports when they come. This is how they must present their strat plans. This is how they must present their annual reports on their strat plan. So there is a model about which I think in the future we will have to circulate to you, so that it doesn't go anywhere where it wants, but it comes structured so that the committee should be in a position to understand. Exactly, because the committee is not a police, we are not police.
we are actually the people who have to contribute helping you to structure the delivery in the way that our manifesto suggests. So we need therefore to be together, as the slogan says, together we can do more. We must work together in order to structure that what you do has value at ground, as you are saying, that the purpose of what you are doing is to improve the quality of lives of our people. And so it's very important, therefore, that we are able to grasp and see where you have had problems and try and streamline whatever probably needs to be streamlined from the side of Parliament, how department or other relevant government departments can help to, you know, speed up the processes of improving the quality of life. You know, we have had a number of protests around the country, so we want to have an impact from science and technology perspective. And indeed, so far, as we've just said in a slide, it is this year it's only our department that has a clean record from the Auditor General, which means that we are doing very well, and we can even do more when we work together. And so together we have to really find a common ground and even improve more from what we've done. But without wasting any time, I'll allow the members therefore to interact with you. I have Honorable Sheen there as the first, Honorable Ngwane second, Honorable Langarake and Kise, the rest at that, and in that order.
Thank you, Chair. Really, it's quite fantastic that South Africa actually has an organization like the CSR. You're doing fantastic work, and I just hope that we get up to speed really with what you're up to there. Because there really is some great stuff coming. I have a whole pile of questions, but I don't know when I'm going to get through them all. I'm wondering, when I went through your annual report, so I'm going to start there, I had a difficulty understanding what finances belong to CSR and what finances belong to group. I actually didn't understand what the two organizations were. I sort of assumed that it was CSR entities as such, plus group being CSR entities plus the organizations in which you have some financial interest or some, but it didn't seem to add up. So if you could please explain that to me. And then obviously a particular interest I have is you have great people. Do you have enough of the right equipment? Because obviously keeping scientists here at the edge of their field, they've got to have the right kit. Otherwise they're going to push off to wherever they can get the right tools to work with. And I'm pleased to see that we actually are spending an awful lot of money on equipment. But I was confused in the annual report. I don't know if you guys have it here, probably not. Page 148, which says, during the current financial year, assets to the value of $747 million were purchased with parliamentary grants. At the year end, assets with a cost of $133 million were purchased with parliamentary grants. What is the difference between the two? How much kit do you actually have? And then also perhaps if you can then explain on that as to whether you really have enough money to spend. Because I know I've been to a couple of the CSR places and some of the kit there is held together with press stick and lackey bands. And, you know, you guys really, you know, if we can influence to get more money, this is a tight time, for that leading edge equipment, that really would be great. Chair, I think if we have a second round, I'll come back with some more.
Okay, next member.
Thank you, CSIR, for the presentation. It's really encouraging, especially when you hear about the unqualified report from the, because most of the entities really do have the qualified reports, so it really is encouraging. That's my first point. And my second point is about the, you seem to have a lot of things. I mean, you put South Africa in a very great position. But I would like to know, how do you market yourself in to other departments? Like, for instance, you speak about this ultra thin concrete road. Do you work with the transport department and these base labs on low cost housing? How close do you work with the housing department? And also the solar system. We have had lots of blackouts in the previous years. How close do you work with the energy department? And with your human capital development, how do you market yourself to the schools, especially the rural areas, where even if a child can understand some of these things, but science and technology, but in the end, the future of that child becomes very bleak because they don't have the money, they don't know where to go, and all that. And lastly, on your slide, I saw the wind tunnel. Maybe if you could go back and give us, I don't know what is it all about, but you just summed it. Or maybe, thank you, Shepard.
That member.
Thanks, Chair. Thanks very much. without joining the choir, but thanks very much. ladies choir. Okay. You raise a number of issues and a number of interventions, which are very critical. But I'm interested because recently I've had the Minister of Water Affairs saying that cities like Durban and Johannesburg in the near future, they will experience a problem of fresh water and things like that. I know with your capabilities you can create something trying to deal with that particular situation. Are you in a position, because you raise a number of issues around the Olifant River, if I'm not mistaken, but it was about checking the river, whether the water, whether suitable for drinking or not. But the problem is that you may find that there are water that are suitable for drinking, but there is a shortage of water because of a number of reasons, not maybe leakages and things like that. Is there anything that we can do to address that particular situation? I need a clarity on this one. You said you are developing a number of scientific interventions, but at a later stage you create a small company to deploy these interventions. I would like to understand that, because at the same time you are saying in terms of the organization you've got a lot of capacity and things like that. Are we unable to deploy this? That's why we are setting companies or small companies, as you refer to it, whether these companies are permanent companies and things like that, or just a company, it's like an ad hoc company to implement whatever project that they're supposed to implement, then after that. Then the third one, you were seen on poverty. I think poverty is the problem. It's the real problem in South Africa. You raised a number of interventions, a number of assistance in terms of other challenges. But specifically in terms of poverty, rather than saying, well, at least you raise something about health and things like that, but I'm more concerned about poverty, because for me to have an organization like CSIR and then but at locally in the community, people, they don't see the impact and the value of having such effective institution. I think that will be a problem. What are we doing to address and to assist in terms of dealing with this challenge? Because this is the real challenge, the poverty and things like that. Because in other countries, there are interventions. But in South Africa, I'm not sure. I'm not too sure, but maybe you'll assist me.
Thank you, Chairperson. Mine is on the asset mine drainage, the water one. What I want to ask is that do you have any plans of bringing mines on board in terms of repurifying the water so that water can be used again? Thanks, Chairperson.
Still any member with an input or... Mrs. Shin, you said you had another question you wanted to put on you now, because there are a few questions that have been put through.
Okay. Thank you, Chair. A couple of little ones. I'm basically focusing my question on the annual report. So I'm now into the finances. And on page 144, we have lost and stolen vehicles and equipment. Now, that tripled from last year to this year. I'd like some explanation on that and what insurance is involved and what you're doing to curb these losses, because I mean it's nearly 1.5 million rands worth of lost and stolen equipment. That's on page 144. Then the other one that I want to look at is employee remuneration. This seems to have increased by 144 million rand from last year, if my arithmetic is correct. I'd like some explanation of why this is so high, because from your charts that you showed us, it didn't seem like you'd had a massive intake of staff. So if you can just explain what that big increase is. And also, if there are, you know, I'm all for scientists being well rewarded for their skills and expertise, but I'd like to know whether there are performance bonuses attached to, if these are good increases, how you go to measure those salaries, whether they're actually going to deliver on those on their expectations, and also whether there is any policy amongst the staff in the CSR about whether any individuals can take own shares or be directors of any of the joint venture companies. What are the rules and regulations regarding that, please? The last one. There's this entity that is Agrimo in South Africa. I know that we are colonized by the English speaking people, but we have got an entity that is named in a French. In French. It has got a French name in South Africa. So, what is your relationship with Agrimo?
Finally, the questions come from the chair. I have not had any significant coverage about a very pressing problem of our planet these days at an international level. It's an effort of all, which is climate change. We are faced with a very, very difficult negotiation process to have all the countries on board so as to sign the 2012 UN agreement altogether, from developing to developed world. We've got only in a month's time a conference in Copenhagen, which is going to be a cornerstone of whether we are able to move together towards the 2012 agreement at UN level. And
the effort of many countries in this direction rests with institutions like CSIR, and I have not heard anything from this report really highlighting that direction. Now, still related to that, part of our strategy as the way forward in our energy mix development was centrally arrived at Polokwane Conference of the African National Congress, and that was that renewable energy should be at the center of any future energy development in South Africa. As a result, last year we passed an energy bill which seeks to move South Africa in this direction at policy level. I have not heard anything much from this presentation from an important institution like yours dealing with how are you developing renewable energy programs for the government. We are here surrounded by two oceans, very powerful in waves and in storms. And we recently, with some members here, come from a conference in Copenhagen only about a week ago, where part of the presentation came from a certain utility of Denmark, which has mastered a lot of renewable energy based on windmill power, and actually using the sea storms than anything else. They have planted a farm right inside the sea, which is going to generate, according to their estimate, 17 megawatts of power. Already 17% of Denmark's energy generation comes from renewable energy, in particular windmill power. So these are some of the very central things that the institution like CSIR is supposed to be focusing on, at least at this level. I've not had much coverage about that. We are surrounded by very two powerful oceans in which we can, and an institution like CSIR can be able to lead the country in the generation of tidal and wave power based on the seawater tides and waves around these oceans. But it can also even influence the renewable direction of our African continent using this resource that is a natural resource around our continent. I have not heard much how you are participating in that particular direction in this report. We have, because if you concentrate on matters of climate change, there are targets that have been set out. One of, some of the dates set out is 2020, 2030, 2050, in which case it is estimated that by 2050, all the countries, if all goes well, should reduce the emissions, gas emissions, by almost 80% by 2050. And one of the most important component that could address this at industrial scale level would be nuclear power. But nuclear power has got two components. It is fission generation-based power and fission generation-based power. Whilst fission-based power is also regarded as clean energy, but I think CSIR as an institution can do more in starting to spearhead the research based on nuclear fusion research, because literature shows that by 2050 this is possible, that we can achieve an industrial scale fusion based power. And therefore, based on the projects that have happened in the world, such as the ITER project in England, the JET project, and so forth, we should be listening to CSIR's starting to liaise with such projects in terms of starting of taking forward research towards 2050 targets. Because one of the important advantages of nuclear fusion-based generation is that it is renewable, it is clean, and it has very little up to now after research catastrophic failures. In fact, it is what we call a fail-safe system. So I think these are some of the things that I would have had listened to. I expect to listen from a powerful research institution like yours, because these are things that are at the center of everybody in the world, in particular, even the resolutions that are governing our country, our country's way forward in terms of energy generation. The last but one, you had a division in CSIR which was very, very, one time we had an opportunity to interact with, and it seemed to be very, very useful in terms of addressing some of our most sensitive areas of poverty, which is the water development for rural areas, the hydrology division. And I haven't heard much how much it has done, because when they told us how they were exploring some areas and rock bases around rural areas where water could be, sucked out, pumped out to supply the rural communities. It was quite a very promising project. I have not heard how far that project has gone, because I think it is part of a very central thing to look at in terms of poverty alleviation and addressing the rural development. And finally, your HRD strategy. Your HRD strategy seems to, as I have shown here, especially skills development, seems very quite impressive, but I'm not sure whether it is only those three cases that you showed, because we had a very serious confrontation with you before in terms of trying to find, there are many people idling around either with all the skills. I do not know what might have changed, if at all. And if you are training those people, are they going to be deployed? Because we had a problem of deploying those that we had already last time, and we struggled, and until now they were never, they never found, a space in placement. So I would like to know what new strategies you have now as you are developing those cases that you showed. Where are they going to go when they finish? Because we've got people already who have finished, who are idling with all those skills. Thank you.
Let's start then in sequence, Chair. I presume that that's the correct thing to do. With the questions raised by the Honorable Shin, most of which were to do with specific matters in the annual report, mostly financial, and may I call upon Chris to, starting from CSR, it was group finances and so on.
Thank you very much for the questions. Thanks, Dr. Beasy. I must understand it's extremely stressful sitting here and anticipating what's going to come, and I'm happy to be able to answer all your questions. The question regarding the CSR results versus group results. The CSR is an entity created by an Act of Parliament, and we are able to hold shares in other companies. And if you look right at the back of the annual financial statement, there's a list there of our subsidiaries. One of them, for example, is a company called Technifin, which is what we use to license technology onto third parties. For example, the lithium battery, we feed the technology to Technifin, and then they license on and receive the royalties. So the CSR results are purely CSR as in the legal entity created by Parliament. Once you bring in the results of the entities, Technifin, Technovent, and so on,
the numbers are added together and we get the group's results. So any entity under our control is then represented as part of the group results. You'll see in terms of operating income, it's only an extra 20 million. So the bulk of our activities sit within CSR as the entity. So I hope that helps you on that question. The question in terms of do we have the right equipment? You have seen in the graph we invest in significantly. But unfortunately, there aren't any finite funds available. We have to ensure the CSR continues as a going concern. And it's a trend we'd like to continue, but there are challenges there. If you asked us a question, could we do it another 200 million rand for equipment, I would say yes. That's just a three in my ear here. So I think that gives you a sense that yes, that there is a challenge there and we'll continue to address it.
To the equipment issue, we actually ask our units to give us a list of needs and requirements and even a kind of a wish list. In terms of what can you do if you have more funds available. And I must say, every time we ask that question, we get many-fold more requirements or requests than what we can fund. So Tulani, one of Tulani's main issues is actually to prioritize. And that means you say no to very good causes sometimes.
Thanks, Sophie. The question dealing with page 148 and the disclosure regarding the property, plant and equipment. Having read it, it is poorly worded. I agree with you on that. Where this comes from is, in terms of generally accepted accounting practice, there are two statements dealing with how you account for property, plant and equipment. The one dealing with grant-funded assets is different from the general accounting treatment. And what we're saying in this note is, in the current financial year, we spent 74.7 million rand on equipment using parliamentary grant funds. The total spent over the life of the CSOR is the 133 million. So during the year we spent 74, at year end we got a total cost of 133 million on a balance sheet of grant funded assets. And that is wording we can look at going forward, I do agree on that. In terms of the lost and stolen equipment, the CSOR, unfortunately, we do spend a significant amount on security. We are, however, not immune to one of the challenges facing the country, and that's been crime. We had a number of unfortunate incidents, and maybe just to put the amount in perspective, the 1.4 million amounts to 0.02% of our total asset base, the total cost of the assets. So it is a small amount. This typically relates to, there was one incident where all the copper cabling was stolen from the roofs of our buildings. And now, because of the sensitive equipment and the lighting up in Pretoria, we run copper cabling along the roofs. This was stolen. It was fairly expensive to replace. There were a number of small incidents, cars being involved in accidents, and a number of laptops being stolen from people's houses. People take work home, the housebreaking incidents, and the laptops are stolen. This is why we have security at CSO. We have comprehensive security. All the cases are reported to police, and we do recover the funds from our security, from our insurance. The question... Kungeka, I think, will help me on the employee remuneration question. The question in terms of can we own shares or can staff own shares in joint venture or subsidiary companies? If I can take Coricam as an example, Dr. Beasy spoke to it earlier. It's an entity we're looking to create and spin out and commercialize as Coricam cameras. There's certain people who are critical in making that work, and it's typically people who have lived and grown this technology in the CSR and will be moving out with it. In order to incentivize them, we will be giving them shares. We look at each case on its merits, and each case is different. However, these people will buy their shares. They're signing indemnity. They're putting their houses on the block. We invest money at CSR. They expect it to do the same. What we do, what is critical for us in all our commercialization activity is looking at creating BE companies. And we will look to partner with a BE entity on this. And CSR, our exit strategy is not to own these companies. We want them to go out there, create jobs, and do good things for the industry. We will ultimately exit in this case to a BE partner. The question on remuneration, do you want to start, Kungeka?
I just wanted to also add on that last point to say that I think Coricam has been a pilot because they've been spun out companies with CSR employees. I think I can't remember in the time I've been there, so it's the first time that we've done it in this case. And the individual actually exits the employee of the CSR, so there's a transfer process and they're no longer employees of the CSR. We are looking at amending, we currently have a benefit sharing policy which talks to when intellectual property has realized value successfully, then the creators of that intellectual property, of course, can share in the financial proceeds of that. So the current policy talks to licensing activity as such. And, of course, the CSR, for those employees who created, who remain behind, will apply that policy. But for those who've exited, we need to amend as well the terms for that. So we also try and do these things also from learning from practice. Do you want to start?
The employee remuneration increased by 23% from the prior year. And part of the reasons for that increase, there has been a small increase in our headcount. We also had an annual increase process, and a year ago, before the financial crash, inflation it was a lot higher than it is now. People did receive inflationary increases. And we also introduced what we called a scarcity allowance. We were losing people to competition overseas, to other institutions within in the country. And we need to maintain our core research base. So certain individuals were identified and received an additional allowance. Included in the 23% is also a provision for performance bonus. Now, it was the first time in CSR history last year where we were able to pay on average a 13th check to all our staff. Typically, we don't make large margins. And the performance bonus, if you strip that out, the increase in employee remuneration is 16%. Which accounts for the difference. The total provision for performance bonus, I think, was 1.2 times an average 13th check for stock.
I think Chris has covered the main points. Just to say that the scarcity allowance was the first time we've ever done that. We were responding to the market. We're currently in the process of coming up with a comprehensive strategy on remuneration to keep the kind of skills we have. It's not a unidimensional approach we have to use to both to attract and to retain people. So that might change some of the trends, I think, moving forward, but we'll contextualize when we report in the future. We do have a very comprehensive performance assessment process, so the individuals who were able to get performance bonuses at the end of the financial year, it started at an institutional level, at the unit level, and then all the individuals have associated KRAs, which are also peer reviewed across the organization. So we're quite happy that everybody who was able to get a performance bonus, I think it was on good ground.
Chair, we trust that that addresses all the questions raised by Honourable Member Shin. Thank you. Let's move on then to the questions by the Honourable Ngungwan. Let me take first the wind tunnel question, and then I'll invite colleagues also to respond to that.
I only saw the topic. I thought it had something to do with this wind turbine.
For in the context of energy, it is to do with testing objects in flight or aeroplanes and so on.
Actually, when we take an oversight tour to CSIR, you will see that's one of the biggest research achievements that they have there. And I'm sure they will address us on that, not today. They should have addressed more about it, because last time when we were there, we were very impressed about what can happen or what is happening there. But I think that is better when you are there, when you get the experts that deal with that division. But it's fine. For now, let's stick to what we have.
Oh, absolutely right. When we arrange the visit, we'll make sure that happens. Incidentally, your question about Airbus is also linked to our activities using the wind tunnel. And not only for aeroplanes, that's a high-speed one, but also at low speed for modeling what happens around the building, for example. There's a building right here in Cape Town that was modeled. You model the wind conditions that take place in Cape Town to see what the likely impact is on the top of the building in the context of other buildings around it. It's important in architecture to do this. Anyway, okay, let's move on that particular one. There was also a question on, in the context of energy, in solar. Before, it was
sorry,
there was a question of solar. There's one on marketing and reaching children. I'm talking about solar now.
Okay.
And then I want to relate that to the question that you raised, Chair, on renewables, and can we answer that question a little later and tie it to the question on the renewables that you raised. And may I then ask that we, Kungera, maybe do want to take the one on marketing to departments, for example, housing, our ultra-thin concrete solutions and reaching through net schools and Akumon and so on. Yeah. Okay.
I'm going to ask my colleague Hafi, because obviously the portfolio and operations is quite active on the involvement with the government departments. I think that that's the CSR approach. Typically, the kind of problems it solves, obviously, the stakeholders are key in terms of identification of those problems in the first place. And I think that with the work of our colleagues in built environment, the relationships, particularly with the Department of the departments on transport as well as on housing, have been particularly, I think, good. And I think I'll ask my colleague to talk specifically on the examples you cited. But I think, in general, we have relationships. The quality of those relationships, of course, vary because I think also people move. For example, with the change of the political heads in those government departments and even, in some instances, the director generals, we have to go and reinvest so that they can buy in into the projects they're working on. So it's an ongoing challenge, but it's very much part of the strategy of the CSR. In fact, you will note that the colleague who title it is to head strategic communication, we actually see that as part of the big role. There is also strategic stakeholder relationships building. So there is that, but it could be improved. That we don't think it works as well in all instances. But as demonstrated, for example, by our colleagues from Water Affairs now, we work very closely with them on the water issues. Dr. Mandes mentioned the Loscop and the Oliphant River problem. We actually briefed the Minister of Water Affairs I think it was about 2 weeks ago. And her advisors on that issue and the work we're doing, etc. So there is quite a lot of investment, but it takes effort and time, and we commit to that. Do you want to just give an example on the spent film concrete and crowdfunding?
If I could just also at the conceptual level, what we try to do is to sign a kind of a memorandum of understanding with these departments, and with the Department of Science and Technology to hope that these departments will have their own research budgets, which they can use to address their own research questions. And it has had some success, but if I could, I haven't checked with my boss, but if I could ask the committee for help, we could do better. We could do better if we have a departmental budget on research questions, and we engage with that, and we then kind of become more aligned with the priorities in those departments. You want to say? Okay. The other area that we also are starting up with now, and in the same vein, is the state-owned enterprises. And we are particularly asking, what is it that we can do better if we work more closely with Transnet? What is it that we can do better? We've done the work with Corocam, with Eskom, but what other things can we do better? I'm very glad that we have, for instance, the Department of Water Affairs here. But wouldn't it have been nice if we could have all the departments here? And, you know, so there's an area that I think we can do better, but I also think we need help to do better. And by the way, most of our impact cannot happen on our own. Most of our impact can happen better if we link up with the rest of the machinery of government. Okay.
Uh, I just wanted to just complete some of the, I think this is a question from Meng Lingwan on the marketing now to youngsters and in particular in rural areas. Again, I think there we've done quite a lot of work in the CSR in the past. A lot of our bursary opportunities, we go out to advertise in public newspapers. Granted, of course, the reach of those is limited, particularly to rural areas. So we would concede that we don't always reach all those, particularly schools in outside. But it is an area that we're very committed to. In fact, the matric improvement program we cited, we actually went out to rural schools. We've got colleagues in our human capital development unit who are quite passionate about these things, and they literally went into schools, met and identified and set and interviewed some of these individuals we eventually selected for the program. And we can give you an indication later on. I don't have it offhand now of some of the areas, but most of them come from rural areas. So I think with additional resources, I think from within our own capacity, of course, we intend to have that reach. In fact, again, in our stakeholder relations entity, we've got a big focus on youth. We also actively partner with DST. You know that they have quite a program on public understanding of science, and we've got SciFest and Science Weeks, and CSR is very, very present in those. In fact, the minister, I'm sure, can also testify that we're quite present in all those activities. So we try our best. It's obviously impractical to reach all the areas of the country.
Thank you, Kungaka. One also ought to point out that there are various modalities, various ways to reach schools in addition to public understanding and so on that Kungaka has referred to, which are extremely important. It just occurs to me that, in fact, one of the our vision, really, and I believe is congruent to the vision of science and technology, with regard to what we spoke about earlier, what we call the South African National Research Network, is that it must not just be a network that reaches high-level research institutions, but eventually it must be a ubiquitous network that is able to reach all schools, so that school children become a part of the acquisition and reaching of knowledge. That has not yet happened, but if collectively South Africa, this is not just a CSR thing or CSR and DST thing, for serious about this, we want to have a South Africa that puts children in that position, and then I think we shall have meaningfully reached out in a manner that is really much more complete than is the case at the moment. Yes, by all means.
I'm not totally certain, but this is my try, so I hope I'm okay. The international standards were driven very strongly from Paris. The System International de Poids de Mesure, or something like that, which is a measure of weights and things like that. That was all run from Paris. The International Standards Institute is in Paris. And in a way, the certification of buildings and building things is a spawn off of that. And I think that's where the Agamor comes from, okay? So this is for certifying building methods. If you actually visit us, you will see that new house that we built. We asked Agrimar to certify that. But just as a matter of fact, this is supported by the Department of Public Works, and it may even migrate more separately from the CSR. It's always run as a separate unit from the CSR, but it might even be more separate in the future.
When I joined CSR in my Philistine ignorance on languages, I thought they just couldn't spell agreement. I'll move on to the questions by the Honorable Mkiza and M. Lau. On the water issues, perhaps Tetu might want to come in again on fresh water problems and also the one on acid mine drainage and mining company compliance, although the compliance issue now touches on policy and legislation which would have to be put in place by people other than ourselves who can just make recommendations with regard to how companies behave. But so what we spoke earlier about, for example, the study we do on logistics, that then enables people to have the data to make, put in place policies and legislation and so on that will then ensure compliance. But the main point there that was that really what we're saying is that we've developed an asset management and AI technology that enables us to address the issue, to turn polluted water to potable water. But Pat can say more about that. There was also Honorable Mathis, a question on capacity as well as poverty. If I understood you correctly, when you say there's lots of capacity, we said there's lots of capacity, so I do from companies, I think the colleagues have said, and hopefully I was just emphasizing that a moment ago, that it is essential that we work in partnership. Our mandate says that, and indeed it makes sense. We build capacity primarily to do what we are about. In other words, to conduct the research, to develop technologies, to conduct careful studies and so on. It is absolutely critical that we then partner with people who are going to deploy the solutions we may have developed, make use of the studies that we've conducted and so on. An illustration of that was exactly that handshaking on spine drainage with the company, W Western Utilities Corporation. Because ultimately when you have mass rollout, it's got to be other players. Where we spawn companies, it is not simply something we're doing and we're going to transiently, we're going to shut it down or anything of the kind. It is because it is embedded in what we do that we seek to take what we're doing out in the form of either startup companies or whole new industries. We're doing work on which we could talk about in detail, we haven't had the opportunity here, on titanium beneficiation, for example. There's another project where we're working together at Airbus and Boeing, because it's used a lot in aerospace. Now, that's an area where we wouldn't then go out and say, we have technologies to take the titanium, which we are very rich in as a country, get to a point where we make or form titanium powder and make certain components for aerospace. We would not then say, therefore, we're going to build aeroplanes eventually. We must partner with companies like Airbus and Boeing that are in the business of building aeroplanes. So the partnerships are absolutely critical, both with industry on the one hand and with the public sector on the other, as was illustrated by conversations on water affairs, for example. Theme on poverty. One can always ask the question, they can do a lot more, and that's always legitimate, that's always valid. We don't think, for example, necessarily that the housing example is not an illustration of speaking to matters that have to do with poverty, because these are low-cost housing issues. What we're saying, let's find the solution. A low-cost and medium-cost solution to housing that is better than we currently have through the use of technology, the thin concrete, and no pun intended, is an illustration thereof. Now, there are other things that we could have spoken about, such as food, which is touched on, actually. For example, genetically modified, the sorghum, work we're doing on sorghum in order to make it have the appropriate nutrients, but it need not just be sorghum, the other areas of activity, drought-resistant maize, and so on. There's a whole story we can talk about here. But let's also remember that CSIR is not the only institution here. There's also the Agricultural Research Council, there's the Medical Research Council, and so on. And if we took a national view, we would talk about all those institutions, and we have not had the opportunity to talk about linkages and what these other institutions do, because obviously they also come here and represent themselves. May I ask Pat then perhaps to comment on water and
Thank you, Dr. Sabisi. Honorable Kizzy, it's a significant challenge to give you a shortish answer to your question around what we're doing in water and how do we deal with it. The map on the one graphic shown really does illustrate that water is in limited supply, and yes, there will come a time, and it will vary geographically depending on where the supply and the demand is, where we are seriously constrained in terms of water available to large, especially large metros. Bear in mind that Johannesburg is quite unique as a large metro, and that it sits on top of a catchment. Most big cities occur where there's good water supplies in the first place, or good ports and harbours. Ours was based where somebody found some gold, and it happened to be in the highest area. So there's additional challenges there. So there's a lot of research going around. Well, what? You know, yes, rainfall is limited. The groundwater is not an infinite resource that has to be recharged. And climate change. And if possible, I'd like to comment further on climate change later in response to your questions, Chair. How does one manage that resource? How does one use it efficiently? And how do you judge efficiency? Is it in terms of rands? Is it in terms of jobs? Is it per liter, etc.? And those are very key questions. Implications of climate change, not only in terms of the resource itself and what they may do to runoff and what can we can store, but also what are the implications of China, of climate change on, for example, the most vulnerable, such as emerging farmers, dryland farmers who are dependent on rainfall for their livelihoods. Major challenges there. One of the points on the first slide we had was also a very significant issue of how do we share the water that we do have with the neighbours who have an equal claim, or not necessarily an equal claim, but also have a claim to the water resources that we utilise, and that's not an insignificant debate. And we see ourselves, or we are recognised as actually among the world leaders in that debate. Having said all of that, I think it's a very, very important concept to note. When somebody says, how much water have we got? You can't measure it. It changes with time. And the other very, very important point is that potentially we can use a lot more water than we have available because we can reuse water. Okay, and that really goes back to how do we manage our water resources in such a fashion that it is suitable and reused efficiently. Water can be used time and time again. And that's where the water quality emphasis comes in, because when water quality deteriorates to a point, it is no longer fit for purpose, fit for use. And there we have a situation where, in fact, out of that water that could be available to us, a certain amount is no longer available, or is horrifically expensive to treat. I mean, we're talking around treatment in by mines and so on now. 20 years ago, that was pie in the sky. The treatment costs at the time were just put it out of reach of any reasonable logic. So that's one of the big challenges, how to get that effective. Just as a point of the clarity, we have not established any companies for water treatment. We partner with existing companies. Honourable Malan, in response to your questions around the mines, yes, they are working to purify. Obviously, the Water Affairs has a say in what they do. Of course, we would hope that they would continue to use more licensed CSR technologies, and we would work with them to solve their problems towards that. Western Utilities Corporation itself is formed based, I think, in 50% part on equity held by mining companies in that area, who are under responsibility to Water Affairs to find solutions fairly soon. In addition to that, we've licensed to others, and I think of Anglo Coal and Harmony in terms of neutralization and the several others, and not all of them necessarily use CSR technologies. I would just, to be fair to the mines, also like to point out that at the moment we're talking around the work we're doing in the Upper Olifants, the mining company through the Olifants River Forum are providing the funds for that research, and we are dependent on them for that. Thank you, Dr. Sweetie.
Well, while you have the floor, you can handle also, of course, and move on to your questions, Honorable Ngobo, on both climate change and the hydrology research competence.
Fine, I think certainly, thank you. In terms of climate change, one of the key points, we mentioned the DST 10-year innovation plan, and we have been working very, very closely with DST and the rest of the South African community, if I can put it that way, in developing the R&D plan in support of the global change Grand Challenge, which has an emphasis on climate change. It's not exclusively climate change, but it has a strong emphasis on climate change. As part of that, we have set up, we are hosting ACCESS, which is a South African consortium of researchers coordinating Earth system science research in support of climate change and other global change. In support of that too, we are hosting, we are piloting and setting up the South African Risk and Vulnerability Atlas. And that's a very, very important part of that 10-year innovation plan, because it really takes the information and will continue to take information that as it emerges from research done by ourselves and others, and make it available to people in such a fashion that they can use that to become less vulnerable and to adapt to climate change and as our understanding of climate change develops. And again, for example, local municipalities, small municipalities, small farmers, for example, emerging forestry plantation growers, are amongst those users. These are the people who are going to be very, very exposed directly to the implications of climate change. And then particularly in relation to Copenhagen, we have working with the South African National Biodiversity Institute, who's one of our research partners, recently put together a very, very substantial component of the second national communication on climate change, which goes into the IPCC process. So we are certainly heavily involved in climate change, and during your visit, we'd love to tell you more and show you more. Thank you. Sorry, thank you, yes. That one I can probably, it's a bit, it's we certainly, within our unit, we have a water research focus, and that does include, particularly around groundwater, how one makes it available and makes it fit for use for rural communities. And that, and particularly looking at the health aspects and how rural communities, we support rural communities in the management of the resource, so it continues to sustain them on a continuous basis. That's part of it. And colleagues in built environment are also involved in the distribution of water services to rural communities.
Thank you, Pat. With regard to energy, you're absolutely right. This is a big area. This is a seriously big area and will also be a lot more visible. And in particular, in the context of what we do, i.e., the earlier stage research and then technology development, not always necessarily completely new, radically new, groundbreaking, disruptive technologies, but even improvement on existing ways of doing things. And a lot of the challenge, as you know, in renewables is not that conceptually we don't understand what needs to be done, but doing it efficiently. Better, for example, and this one is here thinking not just of CSIR, but globally. For example, work done by scientists at the University of Johannesburg on photovoltaics and particular materials which improve the efficiency of photovoltaics, and then how we then collectively take that to market, and we're involved in a number of initiatives in that area ourselves. But let me just mention one and then ask Tulani perhaps to say more on what we're doing in this regard. We have decided that, in fact, you noticed when we show the competences that we are involved in, that energy is a focus here, and specifically renewables. And you make a very point about a wave energy in the era that we're in, but obviously also solar. And what we're doing right now is to set up a substantial demonstration facility on CSIR grounds, not one that will be functioning routinely and feeding into the grid, but one that is going to allow us to develop better technologies. It is on concentrated solar, where we are going to make use of technologies that exist already at competences within CSIR. But the big challenge here in the cost, and Tulani will add to this. You remember on N1 here, where are we? on the N1 in Johannesburg. Outside the DPSA, the Development Bank of South Africa, there used to be a big dish mirror sitting there. which was in fact an experimental concentrated solar, which collects solar rays and focuses them at a point. They've taken it down now. But what that dish is called a heliostat, and in diverse designs, but in a typical design, what it has to do is track the sun, and then so that the sun moves, it moves with the sun, so that it gets optimal reception of sun rays. Now that act, when you have a large number of these in what is called a farm, you get them all to track the sun together and concentrate the solar to a particular point, and then try to find a way of storing that. Now the big cost actually in all of this is to build these things efficiently and steer them to track the sun. Also, there's obviously some power associated with just the steering mechanism. The heavier it is, the more clunky it is, the less efficient it's going to be. So one of the things we want to do is to simply design better heliostats using our competent in very good engineering, mechanical engineering, arising a lot of it from our activities in the defense sector, in the manufacturing sector, and so on. Used our competence in light metals to bring that into the picture. The same competence that Airbus is interested in for purposes of, because they're obviously looking all the time for lighter structures. And if we can find a way in the nutshell of making those heliostats easier to steer and lighter, then you can reduce the cost of deploying concentrated solar, and then certainly you're moving, approaching a much more competitive arena for renewables. Those are the kind of interventions that we're looking at. But please, Tulani, follow me.
Thank you very much, Dr. Smith. I also want to assure the Chair that the CSR has a number of programs looking at renewable energy technologies. There are basically three objectives that we've set ourselves with regards to energy, and has been indicated by Dr. Spies. It is a focus. It is an area of impact that we're focusing on. The three objectives are to address issues of access, and I think the example that was given by Dr. Spies tries to address this access from the point of view of saying that there are a number of communities which are in very isolated rural areas where the grid that we have currently does not reach them. And how can you create technologies for these communities to be able to generate electricity locally without having to be connected to the grid so that it can be self-sustainable and self-sufficient with regards to energy? And the example that was given by Dr. Smith is trying to address this very specific issue of access. The other objective we're trying to address is the issue of energy security by, of course, increasing the energy mix in the country. We think that we can contribute towards addressing that. And lastly, it's to minimize the environmental impact of energy generation as well as utilization. And we have a number of research programs that we are driving to try and respond to these three high-level objectives. One area which is a major area of focus is on solar energy, concentrated solar being one of them. But we also have a focus on solar thermal, and we've developed some very innovative and interesting materials which show a very high potential to absorb energy from the sun with very little reflection, meaning loss of energy. So you can, for instance, design a pot where you can put your food in and it will absorb energy from the sun and cook the food in that process. You can, of course, think of a number of other things that one can do with this material. You can, for instance, create a container that keeps water hot, as opposed to, for instance, having a case. Of course, there are issues that we need to address in terms of how to then regulate the temperature and so on and so forth. But the material that we've developed has shown 30% better performance than what is currently available in the market. And we are talking to a number of entrepreneurs with regard to this technology to see how we can then roll it out in terms of making products that one can use for various applications, of course, within the household. We also have programs looking at biofuel technologies. And our focus here is to try and develop technologies that will not impact the feed security. We all know that to a large extent, most biofuel technology that is currently commercially exploited in any way is based on utilizing maize as a raw material to generate ethanol, for instance. And the Brazilians, I think, are world leaders with regards to this. Our approach is to say we don't want to impact food security. So what are the other raw materials that we can exploit
which can also lead to contributing towards the biofuel economy. And in this regard, we're looking at two areas. It's still very early days, but it shows a lot of promise. One is some very novel enzymes that we've developed, which we think we can use to digest grass to sugars, which we can further convert to ethanol. So you're taking sugar and you're making ethanol from it. In this regard, we are working with the University of Limpopo on this particular project, and it shows some very good promise. The other one is looking at using algae, which is also a non-food raw material, to convert algae into lipids, which can then further convert into ethanol. It's still very early days, but it shows a lot of promise with regard to alternative ways in which one can generate a biofuel from these materials. The other area which I would like to mention in terms of what we are doing with regard to minimizing the impact of energy generation and use is the work that we are doing with regard to clean coal technologies. Here we're looking at technologies to capture, store, and sequestrate CO2, which is generated, for instance, during degasification of coal. So this is a very, very interesting approach that we're taking. And in this regard, we are talking to the likes of Eskom, to the likes of Sasol, who are, of course, the major contributors in terms of CO2, to see how we can partner together with regards to further development of this technology. Maybe before I end, I would like to ask my colleague, Dr. Pat Mendes, to also add a few words with regards to this.
Thank you, Tulani. I think you've covered a lot of the points that I wanted to raise, but I just wanted to emphasize the one point around sustainable use of biofuels. I think the world has got some very, very good examples of bad decisions around biofuels, and we certainly don't want to make the same mistakes in this country. Around the sustainability, Talani's already mentioned the issue of around food security. We've already seen how poor people in this country have been heavily impacted by a rapid food price increase of basic things like maize, corn, and cooking oil prices going through the roof as a consequence of biofuels elsewhere in the world. One has to add into that debate, if you're talking on growing something, it has to use water. So you're talking about water resources, and you're talking around alternative land use practices. And that fits into a broader food security and also an agricultural economy debate. One needs to consider the broader sustainability, and we're developing understanding of that in such a fashion that we have be able to support decision making, and we are looking in the next few months to be piloting mixed energy solutions with Invest Northwest as part of their local planning. The other part of sustainability is in the deployment, and one has to make sure that the energy mixes and the energy availability is socially acceptable and affordable. And I think this is something that's often missed, and how does one deploy energy in such a fashion that it creates income-generating opportunities so that people can afford to pay for that which is provided to them, and in that sense sustainable. So there's a lot of work going on around the broader issues of sustainability of renewable energy. Thank you.
Chen, I do not doubt that we'll agree that from the enthusiasm and lucidity of the responses that it is very clear that we're taking the energy issue extremely seriously indeed. And this is just from the level of executive and not the troops actually doing the work, and there's a formidable number of them. But there is one area, before I comment on your fusion question, where you might appeal to you to assist us. It is with regard to the configuration of entities that are responsible for the various elements in the public sector of thinking or executing the research agenda in energy. Clearly, there's ESCOM at the deployment level and so on, and transmission. There's SANERI at the research level, and we need better clarity the South African National Energy Research Institute.
Nexa and
PBMR and so on. So and of course relations with the new Department of Energy and so on. So I think let's look to ways of working with you here as CSIR in better positioning, and not CSIR but South Africa collectively to better respond to some of the very issues that you raise on renewables and so on. It's a discussion we probably have to take offline, but with regard to
Can I just respond quickly?
Yeah.
You see, these are very important questions that I'm raising. I understand the input from your panel simply is a kind of piecemeal address or redress of some of these things. Now, I happen to be in the International Commission of this Energy Security and Climate Change. As we are going to Geneva, I mean to Copenhagen now, all of these countries, especially I'm talking about the G5 countries now, which are a part of our level club, they have already positioned, they have done a lot in going to Copenhagen with concrete positions that this is what we're going to be negotiating in Copenhagen as part of the initial agreement, which is the beginning of the phase 2, Kyoto Protocol phase 2. Now, you see, we haven't done anything, we haven't prepared much in South Africa, but what is interesting if we're in this commission is that most of the positions of the developing world were actually spearheaded by South Africa and Mexico. We are where we are in these negotiations because we had good policies from South Africa and Mexico about this. But there has been very little from our part in implementing those policies in order to be ready to go to Copenhagen. But that's not the problem of the institution. This is now the problem of the policy direction in itself, because that's where everything is supposed to start. Because what I've just raised with you, I raised with this Congressman Markey, who is the head of the legislation that is going on in the U.S., which is 1,500 pages called Markey-Waxman Bill on energy, which is going to be actually directing events in Copenhagen and beyond. That bill has already passed now in the House of Representatives, is now at the Senate. In the Senate, now in the Congress that I come from in Washington, there was Senator Boxer, and Senator John Kerry, who are now that behind the Senate, is called the Boxer-Kennedy bill, which is going to announce the House of Representatives bill, and which is going to actually govern the world in terms of this low carbon economy. And they have the market, what he's doing there in Copenhagen and indeed in Washington, when he gave the values and figures of money budgeted for all these things and to move the developing world away from high carbon economy, you will find that many of what we are planning here for energy budget will be white elephants. You see? And that is why it is very important that we move together. At least for the first time, we were with other chairs there on related areas, and they felt for the first time, because they weren't there, they felt like with immediate effect, to come to Parliament and establish an ad hoc committee which must deal with this climate at policy level, you know, because otherwise we will be left behind. Now, an institution like CSIR is at the center of driving some of these research things, and we need to have money inside the developing countries. The developed countries are prepared to pay us with money so as to move us away from high carbon economy to low carbon economy. And these are the decisions that are going to be arrived at in Copenhagen. Of course, a document that was agreed about now, which is going to Copenhagen. And only developing, there about 17 countries from the developed economies that have already agreed about this. And I was asking, what will the big $387 billion program of energy program that's going to do when this thing becomes at least qualified in Copenhagen? Because they've already budgeted, they've already contacted people. What are they going to do with those things? They are going to cause another kind of very, very difficulty for the country. So these are some of the things that need to be transmitted to people, strategic people like yourself, so that when you go to these platforms where you participate, you know that we are moving in a direction that may not be really well informed. You see. About nuclear fusion, okay? I think the best, these are, I discussed in this thing with Senator Mark. because he said, why then, with all the money they've devoted, I think, 80 billion for research into these new energies. So I said to him, the problem is that in the world, there's been this monopoly of energy by energy utilities, so they are either promoting high carbon economy or fission-based energy generation. So they don't have anything that is outside what they already have, because their things are also going to remain white elephant. So they will always find a reason to discourage research on a certain good direction. That's why renewable energy has suffered so much. That's why nuclear fusion research has suffered so much, because they don't want it. Yet, actually, it has been demonstrated up to a very high extent that it can work there in Oxford. So if you say that from now to 2050, if there can be dedicated research with the knowledge that you already have, I'm sure that we can have a power station based on fusion reactor, which is going to be addressing a lot of what has been a problem of climate change, both at industrial scale level, at philosophy level, and at renewable level. That is why I am saying it is a very important thing. And the Senator of Society is going to go to the scientists and sit down and discuss with them this approach.
Chair, your insights are appreciated, and we look forward to working closely with you in being part of that national fabric of addressing the energy challenge and what our overall stance is, what position we take at Copenhagen and so on, and clearly working closely with our parent Department of Science and Technology ourselves and other Department of Energy and so on. So we'll be guided, but we'll also continue by yourselves, but we'll continue working on the project that we gave examples of, being clever about what we do on biofuels, working on concentrated solar, better ways of doing it and so on. And we trust that that's in keeping with the overall thinking. And then, of course, carbon sequestration in coal and the like. With regard to, very quickly, Chair, also have to respond then to your fusion question and then come to the HRD one. Yeah. Fusion is a big one. You're right. It's the holy grail of energy generation. But as you know the expression, as well as I do, no doubt, that the answer to fusion is always that it is 30 years away. It does not matter when you answer it. It's when you ask the question, it's always 30 years away. So it is 30 years away. Now, what do we do? You know, you are touching on the examples of the joint European Forum at Calum in Oxford. The problem is one of containment. You know it. You know, and the containment problem remains a problem. ITER was formed exactly because no single country could sustain that, not even a region. That's why it's a national program. Now, sorry, an international program. It would be foolhardy of us to set up, and I think that's not what you were suggesting, a program on fusion that is other than linked very tightly to the international program. So we'd have to ask the question, do we want to be a party to ITER along with the associated obligations that go with that as a country? Now, that's not a CSR question. It's a national question. Now, if that national question were then resolved, then we might then ask, in what manner does CSR as an organization participate in such a program? And then, leading up to whether or not the ultimate is a power station based on fusion, it's an open question. We do not know. But and whether we should participate, again, I don't know. But if we do, it's an entirely national question. I trust you'll agree on that score. In fact, one might, anyway, we can talk about that a little further. I'm not even sure that you necessarily want to embed it within CSIR. You probably want to look at a different model.
This is a question of the Department of Government.
Of course,
It's a bigger issue.
With regard to HRD's strategy, may I ask my colleague to my right to handle that one?
Thank you very much, Chair. You have very good memory. I remember that discussion about this time in 2006. As I indicated when we introduced that, in November 2006, actually, the board of CSR then adopted a strategy. I think the key aspect of that strategy is that we wanted it to very much focus first and foremost on us having security of supply of the kind of skills we require for research, so qualified at masters and PhDs, but also at the in areas where CSIR has priority.
And if you look at all of our pipeline programs, one of the characteristics of those is that those people participating in those programs are very closely aligned to the organization in terms of the areas they work in, but also to the extent of even being placed on our campus, because we want them as well to come out of these programs having the skills for workplace as well. We have invested significantly for our students who are based at universities on what we call psychosocial support. In fact, in the report we talk a bit about that, where we actively interact with all the participants in our bursary programs who are at universities, where we actually counsel them on the opportunities available in the CSIR, and also we've got quite an active vacation work program where they come and work during holidays in our units in the CSIR so that they get familiar with our organization. So we're very confident. We're now beginning to see people graduating, and I'm pleased to say that in the majority, all of those people have been employed in the CSIR. I just don't have offhand the statistics, but we will be happy to give those to you. We're also building in the strategy, because this is what the CSIR has been about for years. You meet quite a lot of people in the industry who said, I got my bursary. In fact, my colleague here is a very good example. I always use him as an example. He got a CSIR engineering bursary, got his PhD, went on to work in industry as a consulting engineer. He always cites all that experience. It's become very invaluable. Came back to the CSIR as a big boss. and so there's quite a few examples of those people. So part of inbuilt in our strategy is also to say that we need to build, that's why the numbers are quite significant. We need sufficient numbers so that the economy can also absorb some of those skills. And but the training and the experience of the CSIR is important for them to increase their success for employment in industry. So we're doing our best in that regard. Chair, thank you very much.
Well, thank you to hear that, but of course you know that what I'm talking about is not what I'm talking about, but that's not in my question to reopen for this platform now. Anyway, thank you very much for the presentation. Unfortunately, we're also running out of time. We've got some our local programs to attend to now. But it was quite a very useful exchange, and I'm sure when you go back to your institution, you will then carry out and review the comments from the committee and accordingly try to address some of the issues that were raised here. But otherwise, thank you very much for all coming all the way there and interacting with us. But matters of climate change are very serious, and I think you must be making a standard item of your executive committee meetings now. Because without that, you'll be left behind, also like many others that are going to be left behind. They are very, very important. Thank you very much.
And thank you, Tancha, and it's always a delight interacting with the committee, and thank you to all involved in this presentation. And the wonderful people who prepared it all.
I think another additional question. I think the charity has not yet functioned, but I heard this morning that they are anticipating the Planning Commission to take effect as from January. And I think that's the correct platform to put this, all these proposals about how to get into the center stage of climate change and renewable energy and high and low carbon economy. I think that's where things could be coordinated, because this is an interdepartmental effort rather than just one department. Thanks. Members, we'll just go through quick.